Hello, my name is Sheila Peters, and I'm one of Power River Hospice Society's volunteers. For about 5 years, I hosted a radio show about writers and writing called In the Shadow of the Mountain. It was broadcast on Smithers Community Radio, CICK. While I mostly interviewed other writers, I occasionally focused on a theme, and in November 2016, I gathered together material from a series of books on death and dying. The books mentioned include Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on death and dying, The End of Life Book Club by Will Schwalbe, The Etiquette of Illness by Susan Halpern, How We Die, Reflections on Life's Final Chapter by Sherwin Nuland, Gilead by Marilynne Robinson, When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi, The Beginner's Goodbye by Ann Tyler, The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End by Katie Royfe, and W.H. Auden's poem Musée de Beaux-Arts. I had a lot of fun putting these together. There's lots of books on death and dying. So here's the show. It's about half an hour long. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening.
In BC, you know, we hear about earthquake preparedness. We hear about smoke detectors and fire escape routes. And even though most of us will never experience the need for either, and we're all crossing our fingers as I say that, we can be pretty sure we will all die. It's one of those that comes with the ticket as we arrive. And I think it's really a good idea to think about that and plan for it as best we can. Now, of course, as the baby boomers draw close to what Oliver Schroer called the waterfall at the outlet of the lake we call life, there's more and more information, more and more calls to action, as well as an increase in resources for palliative care. We now even have medical assistance in dying protocols established in our health regions, so preparing for death is really coming to the forefront these days. We can no longer say that nobody talks about it, I think, and this show, of course, will partly demonstrate that. However, I'm not going to do a how-to. This is a show about writers and writing, and once you start to look around, you'll find dozens, if not hundreds, of books about dying. I can think of As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, The Death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy, Death in Venice by Thomas Mann, just to begin the list. There's an amazing book by Joan Didion called The Year of Magical Thinking, which was written after the death of her husband, the sudden death of her husband. I just finished reading one called The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End by Katie Royfe, and it sort of details it connects what writers such as Dylan Thomas, John Updike, to name a couple of them, how the interest and obsession with death and dying ran through their work, and also how they then approached their own death. So it's a strange book, but it's quite interesting to read to see how she ties those together. Now, some of us go to stories, novels, poetry to deepen our understanding of life and death. Some of us, you know, go to more straightforward resources that give us some how-to suggestions and guides. And today I'm going to point out a mixture. I think that there's a few books that combine practical information with some very good writing, books that might get you thinking in the way that's best suited to your own feelings and personality and your own culture. One of the first books that really began to change the thinking about death and dying away from what had become a medical model where people were more or less put in a room, often not even told they were dying, and more or less, you know, left in a hospital room to die, often on their own. But a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross ran an interdisciplinary seminar on death and dying and transition. And that's where she first explored the now famous concept that there's five stages as people approach death: denial and isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Of course, those stages don't fall in that natural progression by any stretch of the imagination as different people approach the end. And they certainly, they aren't all experienced, but that's essentially something that we think about, that when people are facing death, that they have, you know, really, they go through a lot, and it's all of it's part of the natural process. And out of that came her book on death and dying. It was a really important piece of writing that just really shifted. And she wrote that, she wrote it through interviews and conversations and the kind of informed anecdotes that really make up the bulk of writing on this subject. And she gave readers a much better understanding of how imminent death affects, obviously, the person dying and the people who serve that patient and the family. In her introduction, she writes, "Those who have the strength and the love to sit with a dying patient in the silence that goes beyond words will know that this moment is neither frightening nor painful, but a peaceful cessation of the functioning of the body. Watching a peaceful death of a human being reminds us of a falling star, one of a million lights in a vast sky that flares up for a brief moment, only to disappear into the endless night forever. To be a therapist to a dying patient makes us aware of the uniqueness of each individual in this vast sea of humanity. It makes us aware of our finiteness, our limited lifespan. Few of us live beyond our 70 years, and yet in that brief time, most of us create and live a unique biography and weave ourselves into the fabric of human history." So her work and that of British nurse Cecily Saunders gave rise to the current hospice movement, which provides compassionate care and comfort to people, to help people and their families through the dying process. And here in Smithers, the Buckley Valley Hospice Society has been active for many, many years. Now, it's easy enough to talk about these things in the abstract, but it can be very difficult to begin a conversation about death. For many years, and I have to say for many physicians in practice still today, it just didn't happen, nor for many families. And a book to think about checking out is The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwalbe. And he describes one approach that he found really effective. Between the time his mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and her death 2 years later, she and Will read and discussed nearly 50 books. It began when he was sitting with her in a hospital waiting room, and he asked her what she was reading. Her answer was Wallace Stegner's novel, Crossing to Safety, about the lifelong friendship of two couples, one of the women now dying of cancer. The novel gave the Schwalbes a way to have a sideways conversation about what they were facing. Over those 2 years, they read a broad range of new and old books, from Stieg Larsson's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo to Alan Bennett's The Uncommon Reader, a lovely novella that imagines the Queen of England becoming a serious reader, and I highly recommend it. That particular book doesn't have anything to do with death and dying in particular, but each book they read gave them an avenue to talk about something that was going on in their lives, his and hers, not just about death, but about the things that matter to them. In the end, he says his mom taught him that reading isn't the opposite of doing, it's the opposite of dying. I will never be able to read my mom's favorite books without thinking of her. And when I pass them on and recommend them, I'll know that some of what made her goes with them, that some of my mother will live on in those readers. This book is like belonging to a perfect book club. You don't actually have to go anywhere, but you get to listen in on the conversations about the books. One of their selections was The Etiquette of Illness, What to Say When You Can't Find the Words, by Susan Halpern. She's a psychotherapist and a cancer survivor herself. It's not a literary book in any way, more of a practical guide on how to both reach out to people who are sick or dying, but also how to deal with people's awkward and sometimes painful attempts to reach out to you. I think we've all had those times when we've been afraid to speak to someone or just don't have a clue what to say. And I'm sure many of you have had times when people have said things that really weren't helpful. One of Halpern's suggestions is to find out all you can about someone's illness. Now, she's clear that that's not so you can fill them in with a bunch of internet facts or, you know, harangue them about all the alternate treatments, but so you can understand what they might be facing. My husband, who worked in palliative care before he retired, said that people want to know what to expect as they or their loved ones dies. The knowledge for many people helps lessen their fear. An amazing book that does just that is called How We Die, Reflections on Life's Final Chapter by Sherwin Nuland, published in 1993. He's both a doctor and a wonderful writer, and he outlines different paths by which death might come: heart attack, cancer, murder, accident, Alzheimer's. And he does that in order to give you a sense of what might be coming. And he certainly doesn't shy away from the difficulties. Kubler-Ross talked about a peaceful death, and he's pretty clear that all deaths aren't necessarily peaceful. Many aren't. But he gives information that could be helpful. His opening epigraph states, "Death hath 10,000 several doors for men to take their exits." And these lines from John Webster's 17th century play, The Duchess of Malfi, are not only expressive, they give a sense of the literary underpinning of his thinking and writing about death. He experienced many losses in his own life, beginning with his mother when he was 10, and he interweaves illustrations from his own experience and evocative selections from great writers with current medical knowledge. His closing remarks, like those of Kubler-Ross, talk about hope, and I'll just read you an excerpt here. "The solitary death is now so well recognized that our society has organized against it, and well we should. From the wisdom of the legal documents called advance directives to the questionable philosophies of suicide societies, a range of options exists, and at the bottom the goal of each of them is the same: a restoration of certainty that when the end is near, there will be at least this source of hope, that our last moments will be guided not by the bioengineers, but by those who know who we are. This hope, the assurance that there will be no unreasonable efforts, is an affirmation that the dignity to be sought in death is the appreciation by others of what one has been in life. It is a dignity that proceeds from a life well lived and from the acceptance of one's own death as a necessary process of nature that permits our species to continue in the form of our own children and the children of others. It is also the recognition that the real event taking place at the end of life is our death, not the attempts to prevent it. We have somehow been so taken up with the wonders of modern science that our society puts the emphasis in the wrong place. It is the dying that is the important thing. The central player in the drama is the person dying. The dashing leader of that bustling squad of his would-be rescuers is only a spectator, and a groundling at that. In ages past, the hour of death was, insofar as circumstances permitted, seen as a time of spiritual sanctity and of a last communion with those being left behind. The dying expected this to be so, and it was not so easily denied them. It was their consolation and the consolation of their loved ones for the parting, and especially for the miseries that had very likely preceded it. For many, this last communion was the focus, not only of the sense that a good death was being granted them, but of the hope they saw in the existence of God and an afterlife. It is ironic that in redefining hope, I should find it necessary to call attention to what was until very recently the precinct in which most people would seek it. Much less commonly than at any other time in this millennium do the dying nowadays turn to God and the promise of an afterlife, when the present life is fading. It is not for medical personnel or skeptics to question the faith of another, particularly when that other is facing eternity. Agnostics and even atheists have been known to find solace in religion at such times, and their drastic changes of heart are to be respected. How many times when I was a young surgeon did I hear a physician or nurse scoff at the sacrament of extreme unction because it's just like telling him that he's about to die, and then see him or her slow to call the priest whose presence, had the patient only known the truth, he would have preferred over the doctor's. Years ago, my hospital had an illness category called the danger list. When a Catholic's name was entered on it, his priest was automatically summoned. Among the several reasons such a list is no longer in existence is the official reluctance to scare a patient by the appearance in his room of someone with a clerical collar, because this has been so often a person's first intimation that his life is waning. In such ways did hospital officialdom deny hope, and even religious faith was subverted to accomplish it. Sometimes a dying person's source of hope can be as undemanding as the wish to live until a daughter's graduation, or even a holiday that has particular meaning. The medical literature documents the power of this kind of hope, describing instances in which it has maintained not only the life, but the optimism of a dying man or woman for the necessary period. Every doctor and many laymen can tell of individuals who survived weeks beyond the most extreme expectations in order to have one last Christmas or to await the sight of a dear face arriving from some distant land. The lesson in all of this is well known. Hope lies not only in an expectation of cure or even the remission of present distress. For dying patients, the hope of cure will always be shown to be ultimately false. And even the hope of relief too often turns to ashes. When my time comes, I will seek hope in the knowledge that, insofar as possible, I will not be allowed to suffer or be subjected to needless attempts to maintain life. I will seek it in the certainty that I will not be abandoned to die alone. I am seeking it now in the way I try to live my life, so that those who value what I am will have profited by my time on earth and be left with comforting recollections of what we have meant to one another. There are those who will find hope in faith and their belief in an afterlife. Some will look forward to the moment a milestone is reached or a deed is accomplished. There are even some whose hope is centered on maintaining the kind of control that will permit them the means to decide the moment of their death, or actually to make their own quietus unhindered. Whatever form it may take, each of us must find hope in his or her own way. Now, I think that's a pretty amazing piece of writing. He doesn't shy away from the difficulties. And if you're interested, I really encourage you to take a look for that, How We Die. It's not for the faint of heart, though. Some of the passages are difficult. Of course, how people approach old age and dying varies. Reverend John Ames, a character in American writer Marilynne Robinson's novel Gilead, set in 1950 Iowa, was surprised in his elderly bachelorhood, not only with a wife, but a son. And the whole novel, which really goes back over the course of his life, is written as a letter to his very young and unexpected son. And this is how it begins. It's written in his voice. I told you last night that I might be gone some time, and you said, where? And I said, to be with the good Lord. And you said, why? And I said, because I'm old. And you said, I don't think you're old. And you put your hand in my hand, and you said, you aren't very old, as if that settled it. I told you you might have a very different life from mine and from the life you've had with me, and that would be a wonderful thing. There are many ways to live a good life. And you said, Mama already told me that. And then you said, don't laugh, because you thought I was laughing at you. You reached up and put your fingers on my lips and gave me that look I never in my life saw on any other face besides your mother's. It is a kind of furious pride, very passionate and stern. I'm always a little surprised to find my eyebrows unsinged after I've suffered one of those looks. I will miss them. It seems ridiculous to suppose the dead miss anything. If you're a grown man when you read this, it is my intention for this letter that you will read it then. I'll have been gone a long time. I'll know most of what there is to know about being dead, but I'll probably keep it to myself. That seems to be the way things are. I don't know how many people have asked me what death is like, sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold on to my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew and they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say, and then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio when I got one in the dark as often as not. Do you remember this house? I think you must a little. I grew up in parsonages. I've lived in this one most of my life, and I've visited in a good many others because my father's friends and most of our relatives also lived in parsonages. And when I thought about it in those days, which wasn't too often, I thought this was the worst of them all, the draftiest and the dreariest. Well, that was my state of mind at the time. It's a perfectly good old house, but I was all alone in it then. And that made it seem strange to me. I didn't feel very much at home in the world. That was a fact. Now I do. And now they say my heart is failing. The doctor used the term angina pectoris, which has a theological sound like misericordia. Well, you expect these things at my age. My father died an old man, but his sisters didn't live very long, really, so I can only be grateful. I do regret that I have almost nothing to leave you and your mother. A few old books no one else would want. I never made any money to speak of, and I never paid any attention to the money I had. It was the furthest thing from my mind that I'd be leaving a wife and child, believe me. I'd have been a better father if I'd known. I'd have set something by for you. That is the main thing I want to tell you. That I regret very deeply the hard times I know you and your mother must have gone through, with no real help from me at all, except my prayers. And I pray all the time. I did while I lived, and I do now, too. That is how things are in the next life. I can hear you talking with your mother, you asking, she answering. It's not the words I hear, just the sounds of your voices. You don't like to go to sleep, and every night she has to sort of talk you into it all over again. I never hear her sing except at night from the next room when she's coaxing you to sleep, and then I can't make out what song it is she's singing. Her voice is very low. It sounds beautiful to me, but she laughs when I say that. For a dying man, I feel pretty good, and that is a blessing. Of course your mother knows about it. She said if I feel good, maybe the doctor is wrong. But at my age, there's a limit to how wrong he can be. That's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming, and then sometimes those very same people come into your study and tell you the most remarkable things. There's a lot under the surface of life, everyone knows that, a lot of malice and dread and guilt, and so much loneliness where you wouldn't really expect to find it either. So that's from the opening of Marilyn Robson's Gilead, a really beautiful book. She's got a trilogy set in the same town, and it's not for everyone. They're very slow and thoughtful, but I really enjoy them. Now, one of the latest books that comes about dying, the hottest one these days, is from a fellow called Paul Kalanithi. When Breath Becomes Air. He was 36 and on the verge of completing 10 years training as a neurosurgeon when he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. You know, one day he's a doctor trying to save people, and the next he's a patient struggling to live. And what it does, the book When Breath Becomes Air, which is a beautiful title, chronicles his transformation from a real naive medical student, possessed, as he wrote, by the question of what, given that all organisms die, makes a virtuous and meaningful life. He then became a young neurosurgeon at Stanford, guiding patients often towards a deeper understanding of death that was coming to them. And finally, when he became a new father, he himself was facing his own mortality. And he wrote, when he died in March 2015, he was still working on the book, and he wrote, I began to realize that coming face to face with my own mortality, in a sense, has changed nothing and everything. 7 words from Samuel Beckett began to repeat in my head. I can't go on. I'll go on. It's always interesting to see how people turn to literature, whatever form that literature might take, to find meaning and its expression at the large moments of life and as death approaches. And yeah, it's great. It really does provide solace and hope and for people. And of course, things do go on. And the best medicine for a so-called good death is a good life. As Newland said, I just finished reading Anne Tyler's novel, The Beginner's Guide, about a man whose wife begins to visit him after her sudden death a few months earlier. And he asks a few people if they've heard of people being visited by the dead. And this is what she writes. My friend Luke told me once that he'd been considering my question about whether the dead ever visit. I've decided, he said, that they don't visit. But I think if you knew them well enough, if you'd listened to them closely enough while they were still alive, you might be able to imagine what they would tell you even now. So the smart thing to do is to pay attention while they're living. That's only my opinion. Before I wrap up this morning's edition of In the Shadow of the Mountain, I'd like to go to W.H. Auden. There's something so detached about his writing, it's hard to know how deep the irony in it goes, but I think the feeling's definitely there. His poem, Musée de Beaux-Arts, captures that feeling, so often described in novels and poems and songs. The disbelief that people face when they're grieving, that life goes on even after you've lost everything that matters. It's what The Beginner's Goodbye captures so well. The Musée de Beaux-Arts was published in 1940 when there was quite a lot of dying going on. And this is how it goes. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there must always be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forget that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. Well, that's quite an ending there. I want to thank you very much for listening to In the Shadow of the Mountain this morning with my theme of death and dying, and just wish you all well during the upcoming Christmas season. And I think we'll go out on today's show with Leonard Cohen, who died just in November, with his wonderful closing time. Thanks again.
On the polka dots, and his partner found, and his partner lost, and it's hell to pay when the fiddler stops. It's closing time. Yeah, we're lonely with romantic and satellites with acid, and the soul's spirits crying when it was to be. And the summer night swimming naked, there's a mighty expectation of relief. So we struggle and we stagger down the snakes and up the ladder to the tower where the blessed hours chime. And I swear it happened just like this aside.